Too much scrolling for June 5th, 2020. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hasenflaw.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
And we are here at the end, the finish line of A Study in Scarlet, chapter 14, the final chapter of this interesting mystery.
Is COVID-19 still around, Steve?
No. You see all those people on the streets? It's gone. Don't worry about it.
Oh, good, good, good. But can we keep doing this?
I think we are going to keep doing this. I think COVID-19 is still a problem. I think that we, 2 weeks from now, we might see a spike in cases of COVID-19, maybe. Ooh. But here we are at the end of this mystery. Jefferson Hope is in custody, and all is well with the world, right?
Well, we don't have a lot of hope for Jefferson Hope.
Yeah, remember chapter 13, we found out Jefferson Hope is in the middle of a fatal heart problem. And
his days are short.
Yep, chapter 14 begins with the reveal that Jefferson Hope has died in police custody and he will not face any earthly punishment for his crimes. This is certainly Doyle's viewpoint on death and life and punishment right here.
I love the quote right at the beginning of this chapter. A higher judge had taken the matter in hand, and Jefferson Hope had been summoned before a tribunal where strict justice would be meted out to him. On the very night after his capture, the aneurysm burst, and he was found in the morning stretched upon the floor of the cell with a placid smile upon his face, as though he had been able in his dying moments to look back upon a useful life and on work well done. Ooh, what do you guys think of that? Jefferson's peaceful demise.
Work well done? A life spent in a vengeance?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Holy cow. And certainly he will be judged, you know, to the tradition, the religious tradition, absolutely.
And this is definitely in stark contrast to the wretched, contorted faces of Stangerson and Drebber. There's something about the look on your face when you die, whether you feel like you have done your life's work or if you are being taken from this world in Doyle's view.
And I like that too. I'm going to add to that, you know, all three of them are being judged, right? If they're the eternal.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's interesting because the way that he frames this, right? He has been summoned before a tribunal where strict justice would be meted out to him. So that, of course, is heaven where God will judge him and or the afterlife, I suppose, where God will mm-hmm. judge him. And it sounds like he's feeling pretty comfortable with the judgment of the Almighty.
Goodness.
Doyle introduces Sherlock's philosophy and approach here in the final chapter.
As I was reading this, immediately I was like, well, Doyle has certainly put his note on how Sherlock is going to approach things in here. And there was three things I picked out. I picked out in solving a problem of this sort, the grand thing is to be able to reason backwards. That is a very useful accomplishment and a very easy one. But people do not practice it much. In the everyday affairs of life, it is more useful to reason forwards. And so the other comes to be neglected. And so what do we know about Sherlock from here? Well, we're shown how he's going to reason this out. He goes on to say, most people, if you describe a train of events to them, will tell you what the result would be. They can put those events together in their minds and argue from them that something will come to pass. There are a few people, however, who, if you told them a result, would be able to evolve from their own inner consciousness what the steps were which led up to the result. This power is what I mean when I talk of reasoning backwards or analytically. Once again, this is showing how Sherlock is approaching the information. I review it, and I have this ability to kind of look backwards and see what happens. He's not Miss Cleo in the sense, or John Edwards, where he's clairvoyant type of thing, but he's using logic to kind of put together what ended up happening.
When I was first introduced to Sherlock Holmes, the idea of showing a child these stories is that analysis of deductive reasoning. How do we deduce something from the evidence given from the past? And this is Doyle right there giving us this is the purpose of this story.
But, you know, if you take that to note, I mean, certainly experience gives you that. But it also could be confirming prejudice. It could be your biases. In a university setting, we would want peer review, right? Sherlock's not asking for peer review. Sherlock is almost a superhuman person with this power, this ability, his use of logic, his ability to guess what is happening. And like I said, I think this is Doyle's notes on this character.
I just want to jump in here and say that as Sherlock is putting forward this, you know, philosophical approach of like, how do you reason? What are the different approaches to reasoning? He says, most people reason forward, thinking, of course, towards the future. I reason backward. Now, this I would also note is one of the reasons that I think detective fiction is so powerful, because it's true. What he says here is absolutely true. Most stories take us from the beginning through to the end. The detective story fundamentally plays with temporality. And so the idea of like, what is a detective story? It's a story of two stories. There's the story of a detective solving a crime. And that story is always the uncovering of a previous story, which is how did that crime happen in the first place? In Western culture, we tend to have this very future-oriented perspective on everything. And that's something that in this time of quarantine, I think a lot of us are kind of slowing down time. We have talked on this show, but I mean, I've talked to many people, as I'm sure you have, of how time feels really different during the pandemic, right? And this notion of playing with temporality is, I think, right at the center of the detective genre. 1887, we got a lot of detective narratives out there, but Doyle is shaping the genre pretty substantially with this character, and I think with statements like these.
And he's playing with genre so much. He's got so many different genres that he's writing in this story. We've noted it very clearly that some of them are not my genre, but yes, the basic mystery, the detective story is right there.
And then another thing I would note about this conversation in which he is really like laying out quite clearly his philosophy of how to solve crimes and really how to act and think in the world when it comes to questions of temporality, Gregson and Lestrade are not present, right? He is giving these gems only to Watson. And I think that's really interesting. Why do you guys think that is, that Sherlock doesn't share these ideas with Gregson and Lestrade?
Well, I mean, I think we're going to get that at the end. It's going to be apparent, but Holmes is looking for a confidant, ultimately. Yeah. He's looking for someone to share this experience with.
And also like an audience to appreciate his performance, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes, we've seen so often that joy that Sherlock gets when he has an audience. He really loves being appreciated, and Watson is there to be that audience for him, for sure.
Every magician needs the assistant, right? The assistant makes, I shouldn't say everyone, but many of them use an assistant. Yeah. And it makes that experience smoother.
And Doyle puts this out for us. He says, as Sherlock, but this is definitely Doyle's words, Doyle tells us, what you do in this world is a matter of no consequence. The question is, what can you make people believe that you have done? That's pretty telling for Doyle to spell that out for us.
Sure.
This is kind of the beginning of Sherlock's philosophy of the work is its own reward. He doesn't want to have Lestrade and Gregson in on the solution to this case from his perspective. He wants his work to stand on its own. He'll tell Watson about it because Watson is that confidant, that really close friend. But no, he doesn't really want the other two in on this.
Okay.
So as we find out exactly how Holmes solved this case, he explains to us that he telegraphed to Cleveland to find out about Drebber's history. Now, how did he get there, right? And that was maybe one of the few mysteries we still had after we got that whole backstory. And so I was super fascinated, and we've already talked about this with peaceful or contorted faces, that one of the ways he got there was by looking at the dead man's face on that very first day. There was no wound upon the dead man's person, but the agitated expression upon his face assured me that he had foreseen his fate before it came upon him. Men who die from heart disease or any sudden natural cause never by any chance exhibit agitation upon their features. I don't know if that's true.
I don't know if that's true either, but I get what he's saying there, is that this contorted, this face was so contorted that it made Watson almost sick, even though he had been through war. This was a especially contorted feature. And so I see what Doyle is trying to say there, but I don't know that there's never in heart disease.
Right. And then he explains that once he saw the man had definitely been killed, now came the great question as to the reason why. Robbery had not been the object of the murder, for nothing was taken. Was it politics then, or was it a woman?
Those are your options. There's only three reasons why people are murdered.
Money.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Passions of life, right?
Doyle does not answer our question from the previous chapter, mm-hmm. however. How much of the Mormon and Utah story did Holmes actually know? Are we supposed to believe that Watson wrote those chapters in this story? Was that story uncovered to Holmes? And if so, when? That is not explained in this chapter, unfortunately.
Those chapters seem like they were written for the reader, and they seem to have a different narrative. I think you guys mentioned that multiple times, that we have a different narrator in these stories.
Third person.
Yeah, from these chapters. So it was almost as if we were lifted from this by this divine group and stuck in the past to have that part of the story revealed to us. Because when we came back, what did we get? Jefferson Hope confirmed what really happened, and that we had already experienced it.
I just want to know how much of that character development goes into Sherlock's mind. Again, I know Sherlock is a fictional character. I know John Watson is a fictional character. But in my study of mystery and detective novels, I want to know how much the detective knows. And I don't have an answer to this single question.
And I don't want to sound too definitive, but like I said, I think Sherlock knows what Jefferson Hope told him. I don't think there's any way he could have gone back to these four chapters beforehand as we experience the Wild West and the building of the Mormon state. I don't think there's any way that Sherlock Holmes would know that depth of the story.
He knows that there's a woman. He knows that there is a long story getting to this point. That's probably enough.
And if you took out those chapters, squeeze back the last chapter, you could have ended it as, you know, a long short story.
And he also knows that there's basically some early version of a restraining order that Drebber had against Jefferson Hope. So he knows who the killer is. And I love that he sent his Baker Street irregulars out to find the cabbie named Jefferson Hope. That was awesome.
He's not going to leave immediately, right?
Well, he was trying to leave. He just didn't have the money to leave. He was planning on leaving.
Sherlock Holmes at some point mentioned, well, he's not going to leave immediately, because that's too suspicious. He's going to work a little bit and then, you know, save his money and head back to wherever he's going to go.
Doyle confirms future writings will happen with Sherlock, and he confirms that Dr. Watson is going to be the narrator going forward.
It is wonderful, I cried. Your merit should be publicly recognized. You should publish an account of the case. If you won't, I will for sure, Sherlock says. You may do what you like, Doctor. I said, go do it. You can do this. You can chronicle me and short stories and books.
And he's saying it in a way that he's saying, I don't care what you do. You can write your stories, your silly little stories. But at the same time, we know how much Sherlock loves the adoration of Watson, at least, and the public, too.
And this, of course, is after the newspaper has printed this wonderful account saying, it is an open secret that the credit of this smart capture belongs entirely to the well-known Scotland Yard officials, Mr. Lestrade and Gregson. The man was apprehended, it appears, in the rooms of a certain Mr. Sherlock Holmes, who has himself, as an amateur, shown some talent in the detective line, and who, with such instructors, may hope in time to attain to some degree to their skill. It is expected that a testimonial of some sort will be presented to the two officers as a fitting recognition of their services.
Oh, journalists and their perspective.
Which brings us to the ending, where after reading this beautiful newspaper account of the amateur whose apartment they just happened to capture this criminal in, "Didn't I tell you so when we started?" cried Sherlock Holmes with a laugh. "That's the result of all our study in scarlet, to get them a testimonial." "Never mind," I answered. "I have all the facts in my journal, and the public shall know them. In the meantime, you must make yourself contented by the consciousness of success, like the Roman miser." Now, Watson says this in Latin, but I'll just give you the translation. "The public hiss at me, but I'm pleased with myself at home when I look at the money in my strongbox." The end. Okay, that's a weird ending.
That is a very weird theme.
It all makes sense until this odd Latin quote.
Because that is certainly not thematic.
Right?
Who paid him?
Right. The adoration of these men is the pay here. There is no money in their strongbox other than the knowledge that they made this case happen, that Sherlock Holmes solved this case.
If I said a trope, there is this statement is, you know, the truth is that payment enough for me.
The work is its own reward.
Oh, yes, yes. And, you know, that works really well, you know, until you actually need the bread to eat. But, you know, at some point, this is much truer for Sherlock Holmes than this beginning tale.
Mm-hmm.
Except for the episodes where he really takes a lot of money from his the people that he's investigating and pats the check on his way out. Saying,
that's true.
This was wonderful. Thank you.
But I mean, that's what I mean by that, is that at some point he receives enough payment that he can, I mean, basically pick and choose the cases he has, and some of them just are not going to pay. They're just interesting to him.
Right. This is a great first story. This is a great introduction to the classic Sherlock Holmes that we know from so many further stories, even with all of the pain and the heartbreak in the middle, Pam, but that's okay. Even with that, this is really, really good writing, really concise, and playing with genre in the middle of the precise use of this introduction. So that becomes our question for tomorrow. We want to hear from you. We want to know if you have a favorite first story, the first encounter with a character. What's your favorite first story with a character that goes on to have all sorts of tales and adventures afterwards? Give us a call or a text. Follow our hashtag TMS Sherlock Holmes. We would love to hear the sound of your voice. Send us a voicemail. And go to our dedicated Sherlock Holmes website, sandwichesatirregularhours.com, for the list of all of our conversations over the canon of Sherlock Holmes. Join us tomorrow as we wrap up A Study in Scarlet and talk about your favorite origin stories. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflow.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
Where's my sandwich?